This poem is the first of three. They're long and intended to flow one from another, but each to make sense on its own. They've been written with an eye or ear to being read aloud briskly. Hobo, the man and commander. He's almost clear to me, but I like knowing it is an impertinence to come too close without the invitation he gave only to a few, and they by now winnowed to a very few indeed. I know he's a vivid person, sharp, beaked and hawkish, a little haggard, fit but stooped. He was prone to crushing gloom. I don't mean he's dark especially, but he seems a chiaroscuro figure, brightly lit and also penumbraic in the drawing by Eric Pennington, his friend, in chalk and crayon in The Story of the 79th Armoured Division. It was published by Hobart's own command in the summer of 45, before he or the 79th had drawn breath between Normandy and Hamburg and all the flatlands and wetlands in between. In photos, he looks, even as a general, a little like a Jewish tailor pressed from the high street into the front. He is Sir Percy Hobart, my favourite general, lethal in destruction, creative in publishing, at home to painters and with needlewomen. They called him Hobo. He might have been the scholar gypsy, at home anywhere and nowhere quite. He might have been a pedant or an ad man, but was the very spirit of something new. He was the tank man's tank man. Even so, he's not quite an original, even in the field he made his own. He knew everyone in the brutal, swift, new world of armour. He read his Fuller, the writer-strategist, and chatted, even conspired, with Little Heart, the overconfident confidant of generals. It was Hobart took their ideas for tanks and wireless and men and made them real and ready on the ground. He was an engineer who knew ponies and highlands and deserts too. This new cavalry creed of Mongol velocity, speed and weight, protection and punch, optimised, had found its Spartan champion. Hobart's one to appreciate spanners and overalls and chivalry too. He was a herald for the new that would sweep all before it, but be steeped in ancient gore and glory. He knew that long age of saddle and sabre was only just past, and had made great men, and he had loved it as a child in imagination and as a young man on horseback. His patchy charm and petulance, his being his own enemy, refract the light we shine on him. Damn it, I even dare to think my own splintered light is ideal to see him by. I came to this stuff late, put off by, I dare hardly say, men in cravats and cavalry twill, or berets and lapels freighted with fierce enamel badges. Somehow we seemed to sneer at each other, they with their resentments, and me with the Rolling Stones. But bit by bit, the years eroded their reticence, and the cenotaph broke down my resistance. 70 years ago, thousands of men took Hobart's bulls. We will meet them often, these emblems he drew, worn as his favour on flannel and armour, and motored them finally to Germany. They went under new commanders, out on their own, but, plenty of them, remembering him, and pleased to carry the remembrance. They went under new commanders, out on their own, but plenty of them remembering him and pleased to carry the remembrance. They were under new commanders, but under his tutelage and his inspiration. Hobart is an ungowned don, an ascetic amongst hearties, an ideologue amongst sceptical decency. And I am drawn to his contradictions, since I am the self-taught resisting the ordinary, the snob disdaining intermediation, the loner frightened of instruction. The hobo offers us a rich elusiveness, a testless metal. He shows us the varieties of men we need in war, and the varieties of person that might reside in a man at war. Hobart leaves us no memoir. We meet him mostly in his diaries and letters, vouchsafed us in scraps and in the words of others. He was amongst a cohort of thinking generals. They have been far commoner always than people who think themselves intelligent suppose. And they were lucky and rich in biographers. Hobart had his Major Maxey, a fellow tank man, a military generation younger than the master. Maxey doubly earns the right to speak, as he earns an MC as a lieutenant in a Churchill of the 79th in Normandy. He is not quite in awe of Hobo. He remained faithful to the cussed in his hero. Armoured Crusader, that's Maxey's title. And Hobart was a holy fighter for the Trinity of steel, dash and comms. A warhorse for mechanisation, a wolfhound for mobility, a winged Hermes for airwaves, and withal a terrier for opponents, at home or abroad, on his side or not. Not obviously godly, nor naively powerful, nor powered by destiny, like Monty, whose sister he married, Hobo was illumined by everything he had ever read or seen. His high humane art, his plain civilized duty, was to refine killing the enemy. Hobo in the 20s. Hot from India's northwest frontier, his beloved and admired Indian troops and he had soldiered, chilled and soaked in the alien Western Front and been in dust-ups in ancient Iraq, and he emerged longing to discuss and teach and above all to deal death whilst economising on it. Hobo, 2nd Battalion, Royal Tank Corps, 1931-33. And now, the Kaiser beaten and Hitler gaining traction, Hobo is fast-tracked, attaining great heights. His ideas, his practice and his habits impressed where it mattered. Hobart has his first great moment. He forms the 1st Brigade of the new Royal Tank Regiment. In the appeasing years, honourable in their own way, when humdrum good was outflanked by giddy nihilism, the British tank men's warrior doctrines were watched by the sharpest of their Wehrmacht's coming men. Such a good match they were. Guderian, that other self-proclaimed peculiar man, did not seem even dimly to mourn those British weaknesses nurtured at home that made the tank man's creed less followed where it had been born. Let's be frank, the Nazis had the luxury of being crazy for attack and had no other move. The British, be fair now, were on the defensive. Their guard was up against an assault. Their minds turned to fortresses of men and concrete for Belgium and France, and not mobility. We might have hoped, we who were warriored out, half hoped that something more Edwardian, less horribly immediate, or indeed nothing much at all, might do the trick. We half hoped the Germans might remember their colossal civilization and leave us to our lesser decencies. During all this uneasy peace, Hobart was a teacher and preacher, a deviser, manager and trainer, and not quite alone, but often felt it, always leading the charge. He framed and formed the model new army of the Second World War, out of the blameless follies and the crashed engines of war, from every battle in history, from heavy horse charges and siege engines, from catapults and fire ships. But most of all, it was the trenches of the Great War which broke Europe's heart and stiffened his resolve. Pitched against his own side, laying siege to Whitehall and taking the battle out to practice grounds, he fashioned his new armoured division out of cavalry regiments. He told the classy horsemen to enjoy motorbikes and oil cans, to run a hand and eye over bearings and carburetors, as they had once appraised a beast, running a gloved hand over a flinching muscle, where now it was steel links got thrown, not hooves. Above all, he relishes his commander's new connection with their arms and men. He tells the women who craft radio crystals how valuable they are. He tells girls at their benches that they deftly allow a brigadier to talk to his armadilloed crews out there, and tank commander to network in the fog of war. Neck and neck now, tank men, Hun and Brit alike, prepare for the new world. And Heinz Guderian, the Führer's chosen prophet, plots for sudden sucker punches in northern Europe. Canny and literate, a patriot Junker, as told by Maxi, who is his biographer too, Guderian is thinking of territorial glories and maybe empires of Teuton knights. Gladiatorial more than Nazi, Guderian actually translated from the English Fuller's Doctrine and visited the publicist guru actually in England to learn some more. Hobo, the Mobile Division and the 7th Armoured Division, 38 to 39. Hobo, the Mobile Division and the 7th Armoured Division, 1938-39. And even as Guderian plots and builds under grey skies, the British buckle up for a desert war and task Hobart to ready a mechanised army to fight for the hot Eastern Empire that he loves. Hobart is sent to develop the Mobile Division to be formed in Egypt, readying it, as it turned out, for other generals and for rebranding as the 7th Armoured Division, the Desert Rats. Hobart sets to, and teaching young swells now confined to tanks, he remembers his old experiences as a subaltern on horseback navigating Mesopotamian deserts as though at sea under stars. And he's pitiless in having his officers develop an imaginary eagle's eye, but with a gerber's groundling manoeuvres suited to the badge they'd soon wear. One of Hobart's men, quite senior on his desert staff, a cavalryman later knighted, had been in Germany, an invited guest, back in 37, and seen what Nazis were about. Such men stopped dreaming early on. They were Hobarts from the start. Hobo, Corporal, Home Guard, 1939-1941. And then, sacked by his old friend Wavell on the very brink of action, Hobo was demoted and retired from a general's command to corporaling in a rustic dad's army, a look he wore well, as though a man of hedge and copse and last ditches. Hobart scorned to be altogether a man of sorrows. At first in Chipping Campden, somehow perfectly the England profonde of a general retired and resistant, he does lowly, deep defence of his country and countryside, but by vigour and unstoppability ascends to middle management in the Home Guard and a berth in Hertford College and dinners in hall. And the while, in quick time, Heinz Guderian's tracked Panzerkrieg took first Poland and then Flanders and France by storm and showed the rightness of the Hobart way. And Guderian and his men and their tanks got so far and were so, well, relaxed that they paused in disbelief, their engines idling, almost assuming something must now go wrong, and let the English, stunned as they were, slip away from Dunkirk. England wondered what to do with its new determination. It wanted new brains, and little took the fight to the press and thus to Churchill's magpie heart. Hobart was plucked from his 18 months' sudden useful obscurity. Summoned to meet his prime minister, he asked demurely whether he should wear a civilian suit, a corporal's battle dress, or his moth-balled general's gear. Hobo, 11th Armoured Division, 1941-42. Back in power, Hobart made the 11th Armored Division. "I am a man without a future," he writes. No longer rejected nor widely despised, he now feeds on his recent intimations of superfluity. He makes the haste a man may need when he feeds at last on the power of other men's disdain. Hobo's testiness can flourish now. He can afford to squander his popularity, and with the oldest luck in the world, it is picked up where he throws it, and he gains what he almost regrets to crave. This is the time when he drew the first of his bullish emblems, a great black beast, at once agricultural and military, territorial and menacingly protective. It's done in profile and worn everywhere on his men and their kit, as surely as a rose or lily or iris or a lion or heart on long dead young men of armour. He has to win new followers and fans now. Used to making young swells into mechanics, he has to get grumbling salesmen and leisure motorists to become hussars and dragoons. He has to turn their grumbling citizenship into an ardent obedience, building new aggression and turning it outward. And then, when he has this new band of fighters and machines, well wedded and readied for battle, he is deemed again, and not for the last time, too weird and old to lead them under fire, and he is all but fired again. Hobo, 79th Armoured Division, 1942-45. Churchill's own hand once more reaches down, bringing his prejudice for oddity to bear against the army's preference for biddability, and Hobart is preserved from another retirement. Alan Brooke, it's a move which is desperate, maybe almost amused and inspired, sets Hobart to invent the 79th Armoured Division, his last throw, his lucky finest hour. The 79th wore his imprimatur. This new force reincarnated his bull in special, vigorous, intelligent form as a simple graphic head, and he had them ready for the beaches of D-Day and the flatlands beyond. Now Hobo marshals his famous Hobart's funnies, tanks fantastic as well as furious, not disguised so much as reimagined. They could surf beaches and swim rivers and span streams and scythe hedges and slither on mud and fill ditches and blind the enemy and wrap him in flame. They were comical, almost embarrassing, angry deus ex machina. Heath Robinson in a rage, ridiculous when failing and wryly admired when rolling on the British Army of Liberation and Canadians and Americans too. Floating, flailing, flaming, a civilization's weary ingenuity, its updated tormentor. And these devices were not even of his design. This designer, this original, mostly didn't imagine or make the prototypes, but adopted these orphans, took them into his foster home of ordnance, and brought them to maturity by the thousand, and taught uniformed civilians by the thousand to work them, and officers by the hundred to deploy them. And then, like an impresario, he lent his machines and men to sensible outfits, under command, as the saying goes, where they remained proud to be his, sporting his bull insignia, and felt proprietorial about their GOC, the impossible man they had earned the right to nickname. And so they went, these young men, more entrenched in scepticism than any generation before, keener, probably, so Hobart thought, on Churchill than on the king himself. The youngest of them knew war quite well, had seen the face of terror yards across a silvery screen as a cigarette stained one hand and a girl's became sweaty in the other. And maybe they'd seen it closer still, in city streets turned inside out by bombs. It's the old story for our hobo. The very highest command hardly saw him as a soldier. He was not judged as other men, not quite right for the actual fighting, but maybe unparalleled as a mind, a spirit, sometimes a sprite, and very occasionally a sort of incubus. By now, as the war is getting won, and he has made and honed many of its best instruments, and some fine enemies too, he is still just an old major general, always too peculiar, and now at all but 60, too ancient to lead in battle. But he was wise and trenchant. He told his new army, as they were about to be subcontracted to other units to do their specialist work, "I have heard a lot about how you deal with the obstacles you expect, but what you must be ready for is to get through whatever you encounter. You may be landed anywhere, because those in charge of landing craft are even more amateur sailors than you are amateur soldiers. They do land in his contraptions, and he chases them up through Europe like a choreographer refining a troupe on the road, his mission and his love making him fuss so no ill-considered detail of his might let them down."